It was a squid of colossal proportions. It was 8 meters long and was swimming backwards towards the Nautilus at incredible speed. It was glaring out through enormous greenish-blue eyes. Its 8 arms, or rather legs, grew out of its head, which explains why these creatures are called cephalopods, were double the length of its body, and were waving wildly like the locks of the Furies. We had clear sight of the 250 suckers which lined the inside of each tentacle. They were semi-spherical, like cups. Sometimes the suckers clung to the glass by creating a vacuum. The monster's mouth, a beak shaped like the beak of a parrot, opened and closed vertically. Its tongue, which was of horny consistency, was itself armed with several rows of sharp teeth inflicted in and out of its pair of shears. Whatever had nature been thinking of putting in a bird's beak on a mollusk? Its spindle-shaped body, swollen in its middle section, formed a mass of flesh which must have weighed 25,000 kilos. Its color kept changing with dazzling speed, according to the state of the animal's arousal, moving in succession from livid gray to reddish-brown. What had inflamed the mollusk's wrath? Most likely the presence of the Nautilus, which was more powerful and on which its suckers and mandibles had no effect. And yet what monstrous animals are these squids? With what vitality did the Creator endow them? What vigor there is in their movements? For they do not have 3 hearts. Chance has brought us face to face with this animal, and I did not intend to miss the opportunity of making a careful study of this specimen of a cephalopod. I put aside the horror which the look of the creature inspired in me, and picking up a pencil, I began to draw it.
Welcome to Redeeming Reads, a podcast interpreting classic novels in light of the gospel. I'm Dylan.
And I'm Taylor.
And today we are going to be discussing the classic work by Jules Verne, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, considered by many to be an early science fiction work, and even those who would not classify it as such still revere it as classic work of literature.
Yeah, I did read that this at one time was the second, or not this book, but Jules Verne was the second most published author after Shakespeare. And I thought that that was pretty impressive. I think he fell to third place after Agatha Christie more recently in history, but definitely Jules Verne, and this is being one of his most famous works, falls into the category of classic easily. But Before we jump in, Dylan, what are you drinking tonight?
I have a single origin from New Harvest Coffee Roasters. It's called Santa Barbara Estate, and this is my first cup that I'm actually drinking of it, because I just got it recently, and the first kind of tasty note I was thinking that I taste is actually cherry, which is one of the notes on the bag, which is great. That means I'm close. So it says plum
that is
and dark cherry with savory notes of cardamom and cinnamon.
It's definitely a pretty savory profile, then.
Yeah.
My question is, what does it have to do with Santa Barbara?
Yeah, I don't know. Probably. Maybe I should clarify. It's a Colombian coffee, so I imagine it's probably the name of the farm.
Got it. Makes sense. You were telling me before you started, and you brewed this in a 50-cent brewer that you got at a thrift store. Is that
That's
accurate?
Right. So it's actually, it's basically a little like plastic V60 type pour over, just like your basic one. You know, I've had, like, the first one I got was a like $10 Melita plastic pour over that I've used ever since, you know, like my freshman year of college. This was my first upgrade from it. And it's basically, I didn't even mean to, but it's basically the same thing. I guess the difference is that the black one that I have has one hole in it. So the coffee drips through one hole when it, you know, after it filters. Whereas this has, like, I think 3 or 4 holes in a row. So it kind of, it doesn't cone into the center, actually. It just comes into a line, a straight line. And in that line, there's 4 holes that it drips from together. So I don't really, I think that maybe it just extracts differently. because there's more than one stream. It doesn't get clogged as much, I think, because more of the liquid's able to move through it. So I don't really know how that affects.
I feel like I've
it necessarily, but it's a common, like, you've seen it before. It's also not really even a specialty coffee pour over. It's actually like an old plastic thing, like coffee filter to probably like an old 70s, you know, diner coffee machine. yeah, that's probably why it was, you know, sold for 50 cents, but it works perfectly as a pour over and it looks, you know, just like a lot of these new drippers.
Yeah, well, I think that's pretty consistent because even the Chemex is not a new thing at all. They're super kind of classic. Yeah. You can see them sometimes in the set of like Friends and stuff from the 90s. There'll be a Chemex on the table and stuff.
Even so, like James Bond.
I coffee brewing hasn't changed that much.
To like that kind of art
earlier deco, too. You're right.
Mid-century modern.
Yeah.
That's kind of why I feel like a lot of coffee devices just kind of look like they would fit in. Yeah, in like 70s furniture or could, you know, a 70s kitchen.
Yeah, they're timeless.
Cool. What do you have tonight?
I have an Ethiopian single origin. I've since forgotten the name because I threw my bag away. but it's from Acoustic Java Coffee Roasters. It is pretty decent. I'd say definitely fruity overall, maybe more citrusy more than anything. If I were to pin it down to something, but all around a decent single origin coffee.
Yes. The other, I guess last weekend I was over actually at Taylor's place and you served me a coffee there and it was really good. What was that coffee?
That was this one.
Oh, was same it? One. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. It was, it's a good one overall. I'm pleasantly surprised because Acoustic Java doesn't always, identify a lot of tasting notes and stuff, which in a way I kind of respect. They just make decent coffee all around and they don't overdo it. And they are don't feel like they're trying to fit into some like hip niche of calling out those tasting notes that, as we discuss often, you know, mean nothing. So they just kind of are like, here's a good coffee and it's from this farm and here it is. And then you drink it and it's usually good. So
yeah,
I appreciate that.
Nice, that's great. Well, Jules Verne, so French author, right? This is a translated work. He lived in, I think, maybe early to mid 1800s and into the turn of the century. And he's the author of, you know, various other works too that people commonly know. I think they go by the name like The Extraordinary Voyages in English, but Around the World in, what is it, 80 Days, I think? Like everyone knows that one, Journey to the Center of the Earth.
There's another one. There's one that's like about a journey to the moon, which is more from the Earth to the Moon, it was called.
Yeah.
So definitely a more sci-fi space related version. But definitely Around the World in 80 Days, Journey to the Center of the Earth, and 20,000 Leagues are the most popular, partly because they appeared later on in pop culture. So I remember when I was a kid, there was an Around the World in 80 Days that came out. I don't know if you remember that, Dylan. Does that sound familiar to you?
Mm-hmm. I do.
Yeah. So there was, I cannot remember anything about it other than that it existed. But it just goes to show, I think there's a Disney, an older, maybe Disney or like a Pixar animated Journey to the Center of the Earth also, that was around enough that you might not know who Jules Verne is necessarily, but definitely his works have stuck around.
No, I think that one, sorry, I do recall that one. That one, I think it had Brendan Fraser in it.
Did it?
Yeah.
I did not remember that. That's really funny. So.
And some other like child star. I remember seeing that one in theaters.
Yep, definitely.
And for me, the only real context that I have for 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea is there's like an old 50s Disney movie that I think was like supposed to be pretty incredible, like when it came out, but it was just like an old movie when I was, you know, a kid. But that's what like set the tone for like this book. And Jules Verne is, I remember like watching that. And I remember, I think there's like a scene when they fight, like, I don't remember it in the book. Maybe I'm making it up in my mind, but like they were fighting a whale. specifically in the movie or something. Anyway, it was terrifying when I was a child.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely, you know, it's always different experiencing, like, going from movie to book. Again, not that it was super fresh in my mind, but yeah, I really enjoyed the book altogether.
I think it's an interesting that those movies overall are geared towards children,
mm-hmm.
because I don't know. I guess in all honesty, I was conflicted about whether or not I even enjoyed the book that much, but I understand why you would take this novel and it just becomes like a fun adventure story.
Mm-hmm.
So inevitably is geared towards children, but I can also imagine a world where if Jules Verne knew that, he probably wouldn't be super happy, because I don't think he was writing to children necessarily. You know, it's like 400 mm-hmm. pages plus, so it's not a children's sure. book, but definitely in terms of the theme and the, I don't know, the lightness of it in some ways. I mean, there's intense scenes like the one I read at the beginning of the podcast, but overall, it's pretty lighthearted adventure.
And I think that's what is so unique about it, is that it's truly an adventure book. And like it's pretty light on the plot, but it's a sprawling, massive, like, it's almost an anthology. I think there's 50 chapters yeah. in total, right? And like each chapter is almost its own little like episode, and like not much really happened. Like there's, you know, it's, you read about like a little story that an adventure that literally, you know, an adventure they go on, and then there's like danger, and then they overcome it, and then that's it, over and over. But I guess there is a, you know, a larger plot kind of towards the beginning and the end, but most of the book is them just exploring like unique, cool places and discovering new animals and places underwater and locations. And there's something about that that is so, it's just so light on the plot that you can tell it was intended to thrill the reader. And to be honest, like, I think it still holds up pretty well for modern readers. Like, it captured my attention pretty thoroughly, and it was really kind of creative and like vivid in its descriptions, and it gripped me, even though it wasn't kind of a typical, like in one sense it's a pretty boring flat plot book, but it makes up for that with all of its, you know, descriptions and vivid imagery, and makes you feel like a child again when you're reading it.
I concur with you that it's enjoyable. It brings things to your kind of mind's eye that are really interesting, and things you wouldn't have considered when you're, you know, at the view of what the sunken ancient Atlantis would look like, you know, all of these cool scenes. And I agree to an extent. I think personally, just in my preference, it was challenging to not have plot, first of all. And then secondarily, there's no, I mean, and I'm sure we'll try to dive into the sum when we get to our gospel conversation, but there's no real moral mm-hmm. undertone at all, or like philosophical, maybe, or maybe there is in a way that I don't understand. At the time it was written, and I agree that it holds up and that it's still enjoyable to read, but like at the time it was written, it was revolutionary, probably. Right? Like, it's all of these scientific ideas that were just on the fringes and then are being brought into art. But then from our point of view, looking back, I think it loses some of the wonder, maybe not all of it, but it loses a big component of, you know, I don't know, it just things that are completely improbable and make no sense. And to me, there's something lost in that translation somewhere. I enjoy it in the same way, like, there's some action movies that I enjoy just because you want to sit down and watch a movie, not because you want to think about it or, you know, enjoy, like, I don't know, or that you're ever going to revisit it again in the future. And then there's other movies you watch when you're like, that is going to be a movie I revisit and I'm going to think about that more. And I feel like this book is just going to be one where I was like, cool, I had an adventure in the ocean that was interesting and I'm going to move on. That's just my honest opinion. I think I've enjoyed like 80% of the other books we've read more than this, if I'm honest, for that reason. But
yeah,
I think it's still worth reading. All that being said, I think it is a worthwhile novel overall.
Yeah. That's funny though. I got to disagree with you. I feel I feel very differently. I really enjoyed it thoroughly, like more than some of the other books that we've read. And I specifically like want to spend more time reading it in the future at a slower pace rather than crunched into 1 month. Like some of the like vivid imagery is just so, I don't know. It's just so fascinating to me.
That's fair. I'm with you. I think another point of comparison I'm making is to other sci-fi writers at the same time. So like there's comparisons made to H.G. Wells sometimes. Mm-hmm. And H.G. Wells wrote like The Time Machine, which I've read before. And that was a really interesting book on space travel or on time travel. And that, or like even something along the lines of C.S. Lewis's space trilogy, like had some sort of moral undertone while doing the same thing. And I think that that was the challenge for me, is like there's nothing else for me to grab onto. And that's why ultimately for me, but again, I respect that it was enjoyable.
I feel like it's a breath of fresh air for that reason. Philosophize over so many things when I'm reading that it's nice not to to worry about that.
I 100% am on the same page with you on that, because I, even as I was saying that and as I was thinking of kind of prepping for what I was going to say about the book, I think I wish that I could have enjoyed it more, but like I'm like too intense about my reading. You know what I mean? Like I genuinely was like, this is a me problem. Like this is probably an enjoyable book, but in the end it was that like I can't help but overanalyze books, and it's probably
when you like co-host a podcast for 2+ years, you know, like analyzing books every month, it gets hard not to.
Yeah, fair enough. And that's like if for our personality types to even want to go and start a podcast, I feel like there has to be a certain level of like over seriousness and over analyzing, which is just completely a me problem. So I completely respect that. I wish I could just have the like pure, like childlike awe of enjoying it without thinking about anything else. I just can't help myself, is the reality. But should we do a short, a short run through of description?
Yeah. Well, as far as the plot, so we start out with, Monsieur Aronnax, I think. Yep. I'm not sure how you'd really say his name. He's, well, like a marine biologist professor, I think, who is basically trying to investigate this series of mysterious events where multiple ships across the globe keep getting, like, mysteriously disappearing, right? And they set out, him and a harpooner named Ned Land, and he has another guy. What's his name? Kansei, I think.
I don't know how to pronounce that. It's all French,
right?
Yeah.
I think it means council. Like, it means his, like, attendant, basically.
Which is what he is. He's a characters. Servant. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they, so they go out to try to find what they think is the sea monster, or like a big narwhal that's been, you know, sinking all these ships globally. It's making headlines everywhere across the globe. And they're going to set out to track it down.
Yeah, so they think this giant narwhal is ramming ships and sinking them. So they set off in a U.S. Army or Navy battleship, basically, or just something that's been outfitted, you know, with all of the newest tech, and it's called the Abraham Lincoln. That's the ship's name. And they chase this, or they go off looking for this narwhal, the supposed narwhal that's been sinking ships. And it takes them a long time, and they sort of bounce around, eventually getting into the Pacific, even when they finally discover they have encounters with their giant narwhal, and they have the best whale hunters. That's why they have Ned Land on board, because they're going to capture this narwhal, or that's their goal at least. And this narwhal like glows in the water, like it's very confusing, but they basically engage with the giant narwhal, or what they think is the giant narwhal, and they lose. And Aronnax and his servant guy and Ned all end up on top of what they thought was a narwhal, and they discover it is actually a submarine, extremely high-tech submarine that had sunk those other ships, and it's glowing because it's electric, and they're sort of imprisoned by the captain of this mysterious vessel, which we find out is called the Nautilus, and the captain's name is Captain Nemo.
And Captain Nemo, I think, is a super complex character. He is this, like, rich scientist mastermind who's mastered, like, various languages. He's stocked up in the Nautilus. It's like his own personal, like, private museum and library. Like, this vintage, like, study full of books from, like, you know, everything, like, Greek philosophy, classics, science, right? And this book was written, I think, when the scientific revolution was exploding, and so that's why there's so much of this book is describing, you know, animals and mechanics and scientific things. But Captain Nemo embodies this kind of just, like, I don't know, he's this, like, opulent hedonist, but he also is very philosophical and deep and, like, wise, smart, but he's also kind of an island of a man, separate from the world. And we kind of learn as time goes on, like, he's basically separated himself from all of the world and basically, like, the land, and he wants to live in solace. And so when he takes captive these three main characters, he basically says, all right, you guys are stuck with me, you're gonna stay here with me, and we're gonna explore the seas. I think he has a crew, like a crew of maybe 10 people who work for and with him, in this self-sustaining boat, right? There's incredible, like, just, you know, probably 100+ pages just describing over throughout the book, like, how the Nautilus is able to self-maintain itself in, like, cold Arctic temperatures and in really hot temperatures and everything. It's just a self-sustaining, like, vehicle because of his, you know, just his ingenuity. So he's a really fascinating character that we also don't know much about, but he's heroic in some instances, mysterious and guarded in others.
Yeah, he definitely comes across mysterious at the beginning, and he tells his new passengers, our sort of main cast of characters, that they are now also stuck on the Nautilus, that he can't let them go because he's sworn basically to never go to land or be seen again. So they're sort of consigned to exploring the ocean indefinitely, which they can do in the Nautilus. And that's exactly what, I don't know, I don't think I'm over-exaggerating when I say 75% of the rest of the book is their explorations of all of these different locations underwater, hence the 20,000 leaks, which I found out is, like, I don't know, it's like 40,000 nautical miles or something, which is basically twice around the Earth underwater. And they really do travel to every possible kind of corner of the ocean. And I think the neat part about this story is that it latched on to, like, plausible scientific ideas at the time, but things that they just didn't know about. And it really kind of plays in that gray area in a fun way where they see Atlantis, like I had talked about, or where previous battles had happened and there's these sunken ships on the ocean floor, or the Antarctic seawall, and they have the technology to get out of the Nautilus in these underwater suits and explore the bottom of the ocean. And this goes on for much of the book in very detailed and plausible scientific descriptions of all sorts of animals. It ends sort of the major ending section of this portion of the book ends with the giant squid, which ends up attacking the Nautilus, and one of the crew members ends up dying after that attack. At the end, I think it's just fair to say the only changes is that Captain Nemo sort of changes towards the end. He seems to be sort of spiraling, maybe because of things from his past, the loss of his culture, and he's like, I don't know, different experiences he has had. Our kind of main characters, Professor Aronnax, sort of turns away from him. And all along, Ned Land has been sort of oppositional to Captain Nemo and being on the ship. He wants to escape from there. And finally, Ned and Professor Aronnax are able to leave the boat. They are able to escape towards the end. And they, right before the Nautilus is sucked into this giant whirlpool that's like sort of famous, I guess. And they survive and they find refuge on this island. But then the Nautilus itself, what happens to it, what happens to Captain Nemo is left sort of open-ended at the end of the story.
Yeah, again, I feel like the book mostly plays off of these unique little episodes of exploration. I think you mentioned some of the places, ancient ruins of Atlantis. There's underwater forests and underwater volcano, battles with sharks and squid. But most of those plot lines are tucked, I think, towards the beginning and the end of the book. So it makes it a little bit hard to identify like a main theme other than just, you know, the intent of the author is to just entertain with spectacle, right? Visually. And another thing I just mentioned is that, you know, this book probably thrived so much in popularity because of the descriptions that to us seem pretty dull and boring and lengthy. But I think you mentioned, or you alluded to the fact that they're all kind of plausible scientific explanations that, you know, like they verge on sci-fi, but they're almost not because they could be plausible and be real ways that, you know, the Nautilus is able to, you know, operate or whatever. But I think back in the time it was written, people didn't have as much access or education, you know, about these things. And it was an exciting new time where people were learning about these things. And so it's no wonder that this gripped people's attentions.
Yeah, I think that's one of the parts that, for me, like, it breaks down a little bit because there's points where it's so outlandish that this, you know, the ship basically can operate indefinitely underground or underwater. And it never really needs to be, you know, there's all these explanations for where the energy comes from and how it generates it and how it manages the ballast like a submarine would. But it's even this many years later, we're not even close to that that level of technology, which is a cool imaginative idea. And at the same time, it's like there was parts that felt really far-fetched, but I can imagine in a world that where it's more gray, where those things had not been fleshed out, it'd be like, that could really happen. And that would have been really interesting at that time, or even, you know, just several years afterwards. Jules Verne really had a sense of where scientific discovery was going. And I think this was a time in history where that was really exciting, where, you know, the Western quote-unquote world was still discovering ancient ruins. I mean, this is the same time frame when we're basically discovering that ancient Egypt existed in detail, right? Before then, we had very little knowledge that had been lost of ancient civilizations and their languages. And he definitely plays into that in these scientific discoveries and does an overall good job of positively representing what the scientific knowledge at the time was. I remember reading, I think that's, he spent some time in university and had a time in his life in particular where he was more fascinated with scientific discovery and what was happening around the world. And that's what, you know, eventually made it its way into 20,000 Leagues.
I think what you just said touches a little bit on one of thing, what I guess I would argue is one of the main themes of the book, which is something, I don't know, I guess just that the fact that there are, like, wondrous and marvelous things that are just right under our noses, or that are so close to us that we can't see, that are being revealed. I got, vibes of H.P. Lovecraft a little bit.
Yeah. It reminded me
slightly of At the Mountains of Madness.
Definitely.
Which we read like maybe a year or two ago. Kind of this idea that, like, man, we're just so small in this massive world. But what's different, I think, is that this book is, I think, trying to say, or just displays that, well, it's been under your noses the whole time. You just haven't been able to see it.
Yeah, I can imagine a world where sort of the modern equivalent, I think, would be more along the lines of space travel, or, you know, like, whatever the next frontier is.
Mm-hmm.
You could do the same thing as this book has. But you can imagine also this was written in a world where there wasn't a lot of other sci-fi to draw on. So he really was one of the first to, I don't know, bring it up in this way. And, mm-hmm. If you were reading at the time, would have been amazing to read. No doubt that's what made it so compelling.
Mm-hmm. Well, even the name science fiction, if you go back to the roots of, like, why it was ever declared to be that, and I don't think that's something that Jules Verne ascribed to himself. I think that was something that was later slapped onto his kind of brand and other writers who were writing about the same thing. But just thinking about the root words, it's science fiction. It's fiction that is also explaining science to you. Like, it's actually, we think of it as, like, aliens and fantasy and actually the opposite of science.
Right.
But what he's writing about is these plausible realities, you know, that are exaggerated and certainly not real and are fictitious and exaggerated. But there's, like, I think in that name, science fiction, there's an aspect of realism to it, that is just, like, engaging, you know, over and above what we think of as just, like, general fantasy, right? There's no fantasy elements in this book particularly.
No, but I remember reading that Jules Verne, there's almost an element of, like, surrealism built in to this too, where you end up in, like, dreamlike scenarios where things don't quite work the way they should. And it's just a little bit, like, there's so much realism, but then there's moments mixed in of pretty, like, just dreamlike moments, maybe, where things aren't making sense. And I think sort of when Professor Aronnax and the crew are brought on board the Nautilus, but they don't know what's going on, and they just wake up in this room that's like, you know, they thought they were fighting a narwhal, and now they're inside some sort of ship, and they have no clue what's going on, and they have no clue who these people are, and they're speaking a language that they don't understand. And there's sort of this that's a dreamlike state almost. And I think that made the mystery, at least at the beginning of the book, is pretty clever. I think it's not the majority of it, but the introductory storyline is there's this mysterious thing that we don't know what it is, and we're going to go set out to find out. And then once you find out, it's exactly the opposite of what you expected. It's not what you were led to believe. And that made for definitely a good read, at least in those beginning pages of what's going on.
One part that I liked, when you first, like, meet Captain Nemo, before he even speaks a word, like, they try to, I think, speak with him or explain, or they hear that he's talking in a different language.
Yep.
And so then I think they try, like, French, English, German, like, I think Latin or something.
Yeah,
else too, right?
Yeah,
because you know, people knew Latin back then. And and each time Captain Nemo just, like, silently, like, waits and is, like, discerning, like, listening, letting them go through and talk, but they can tell he, like, doesn't understand, and then no words, and then he just leaves, and they're confused, like, okay, we're definitely going to die now, right? And then he comes back, and then he starts speaking to them in English.
Yeah, and he was
and
like...
it's like he's testing them the whole time.
He was like, know? I speak all of those languages, but I just didn't answer you.
Yeah, you know, he's like on a different level.
He really is.
But, and I think, so just as we're still talking about literary features, I think there's kind of a funny dynamic between Ned and Captain Nemo. Like, I think Ned is this kind of like burly, manly man who's always kind of like an opposition, kind of aggressive, the aggressive harpooner friend who's, you know, the opposite kind of Aaron Axe. And he's funny at times, like he just says some funny things, but he's also always kind of opposed to Captain Nemo. And I was thinking about it today that they're actually kind of foils of each other too, Nemo and Ned Land. Like, Ned is this harpooner who desires nothing more than to just go home. And like, I think they talk about how he like loves fish and he loves harpooning fish and then just eating them on land. Like, he's a man of the land. Whereas Nemo is the opposite, and we don't really know all the details of what happened in his past. I think something with his family, right?
But yeah.
There's this kind of revenge plot that eventually ensues, but we know that he's been, like, he has no desire to be on land, and he wants to escape the world and live in solace. And so there's this constant tension between Ned trying to get Aaron Axe to, you know, escape with him in prison break against Nemo. And eventually they succeed. And Nemo himself goes down this kind of revenge plotline at the end, kind of avenging, I think, his family's death. But there's some like surprising character development that only pops out literally in a couple chapters, you know? And it's like, well, this could have been spread more, it could have been baked in a little bit more throughout.
Yeah, I definitely got the feel that it's pretty flat. Like, I wouldn't describe this as a book you read for the character development. Or that you think it's very compelling, at least. It does have that same feel that I personally felt it more with At the Mountains of Madness. But you are definitely drawn in just by pure adventure. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I think in a world where now we're... we think we've understood more, maybe there's less room for this being able to create a world where you feel like it's just purely about adventure. And I think that was the biggest theme that I saw, at least. Dylan, what for you stood out? I mean, I expressed sort of that I struggle to find any sort of moral through line, at least one intended by the author. But if there is something moral or relating to redemption as we see it as Christians, what did you see?
Well, Nemo himself, again, I mentioned, he is this kind of recluse, isolated from society by his own desire. But he's also very kind of like hedonistic in his pursuits, and he ends up, like, I guess you could say he's uncovered like a lot of, like, not only riches but also discoveries that he's basically keeping to himself and doesn't want like to show others. But at one point he says the following. He says, talking about, you know, kind of the reason that he left the world. He said, "The earth does not need new continents. It needs new men." And I thought that was kind of just a deep little quote, you know, that you don't know what it is necessarily, but he's been like burnt by people. And he alludes to the fact that like there is corruption in the world. And that is maybe part of the reason why he's left it. He's been maybe so like emotionally, you know, like hurt by the world almost that he would prefer just to be alone. Mm-hmm. It doesn't come through much in the book, but I thought that was just a unique quote from him. And maybe it's a bit of a stretch, but it's this idea that he just, you know, he doesn't trust people and that he wants to live in isolation from the world. And when I say the world, namely like other people, you know, but he's unable to move past maybe like bad things that have happened to him or his family in the past. And, you know, some of that, as Christians, we can affirm also to be true, you could say, right? The earth doesn't need new continents, it needs new men. Namely, we would say, you know, as followers of Christ, as Christ said, like, you must be born again and become a new put on the new man. Because it's true, our hearts and our minds are really set towards evil. You know, we have that slant towards things that hurt each other and ourselves, and make this world a bad place, right? The world is corrupt because of the people who are in it. And yeah. We ultimately have hope and redemption, and separation from our sins and peace with God through Christ himself. And so there's no need then for us who maybe, you know, have had bad experiences in the past. Like, we can move forward in hope and in confidence in Christ. We are, rather than being isolated silos, you know, Christ calls his people into local bodies, local, you know, churches, extensions of his body, in unity and fellowship, as we strive together in this life. So that's some really deep theologizing, you know, but that's the best I got, I think. And yeah. That's one genuine way that I reflected on just Nemo's self-isolation.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting thought about him running from his past, but then it's like that, like, he went with him sort of thing, I think, happened, where there's particularly, I don't know, at the middle, if there's, I wouldn't say it's a spiral for him, because I don't see that consistently throughout, but definitely at the end, when he reaches this kind of uncertain end in this whirlpool, and I don't think he dies, because we're discussing there's a sequel, that, or sort of sequel, I don't know, there's other books that Verne wrote that include Captain Nemo, but his is one of the few characters that have some sort of arc, and you see him go from sort of this impenetrable, I don't know, perfect manly man, if sort of mysterious and stoic, to, you know, someone who's sort of lost his bearings in the world. Mm-hmm. And even his isolation didn't save him from that. He was, you know, plagued by that. And, the, of course, you know, the Christians, we would say that the issue is internal, and that's why. That's something I hadn't thought about, but definitely true.
I was going to say, it's almost like, as I was, again, thinking through the book today, there's something almost similar to, in Heart of Darkness, Kurtz, who is this kind of mysterious, you know, loner who goes out to explore. He has different reasons for doing it, I guess, but he becomes, like, self-absorbed and focused on only himself, and has this kind of similar, just like a mysterious, it's just, I guess what's similar is this mysterious persona who has mastered the wilderness that he went into, that we're, like, getting a unique glimpse and glimmer of. Very different characters in some ways, but also similar.
Yeah, and I know people have also made comparisons to Captain Ahab from Moby Dick, who's the captain of the ship that sort of is dead set on chasing down this whale. And I think people have made the same sort of comparison there. Even if he's not chasing one singular thing, a similar captain figure, nevertheless.
And I think the idea of there just being wondrous things that exist, again, is something that, like, as Christians, like, we recognize that there is an unseen realm that the scripture tells us about. You know, God is spirit, and there are spiritual, you know, authorities and dominions over which Christ has been, you know, reigned now at the right hand of the Father. But it can be easy, I guess, just to downplay that, or you could even say overdo it in some Christian kind of circles or camps, the whole spiritual warfare aspect. But it's true. And so maybe there's something about just being human that we're compelled to be drawn toward the unknown, because it's amazing. It's incredible. We're drawn to something greater than ourselves and greater than what we're just familiar with. And, again, in Christ, when we're, like Ephesians 1, if we're united to him and in him, like, he is the one who is now seated in the heavenly places, and there's a sense in which positionally we are seated in Christ at the right hand, you know, in the heavenly places. And yeah, namely Ephesians 1, you see all these descriptions just of these heavenly authorities, powers, dominions that we don't know much about. But nevertheless, they're no less real, you know?
Yeah.
And so there is this sense of wonder that we're kind of invited into as Christians, that we don't see, right? That our eyes can't see right now in this life.
Yeah, one of the quotes that I wrote down once from the book was, "The human mind delights in grand conceptions of supernatural beings." And I think that's right along the lines of what you were saying. Like, we have a natural inclination towards either supernatural things or things we don't understand, or that we are completely new and novel to us. And this book plays completely off of that idea. And I was thinking about too, like, there's, you know, a really solid nature documentary that is about the ocean, for example. I feel like I always discover that there's a new animal that I never knew existed before. And I don't know why that should be surprising to me, but there's always some wild, like, you know, the deep sea creatures, which is 100% what this whole story is about, essentially, of like some strange jellyfish that, you know, like lights up and is in a weird shape, or some fish that is just so grotesque that you're like, there's no way that exists. But every time I find out that there's something I didn't realize existed out there. And there's benefit to us as human beings and as Christians in relationship to God when we discover those things, because of the sense of awe it creates in us for the Creator, I think. And that's, I would argue that that's a general human response, not even a Christian one necessarily, although, you know, we attribute that to God specifically. And, you know, there's parts of Scripture also that that reveals that. I think of Job when I was reading this a little bit, with, you know, God's description of the natural world and the, you know, the quiz he gives Job on the things that he does not understand. And I thought about that as I was reading, that there's things out there that I just are beyond me. And even if this book, you know, being written as long ago as it has been now, there are still things I don't understand about this natural world and the world beyond it. And I think that's a humbling experience. It gives perspective, as it gave to Job. And the ultimate response for us then is worship, right? That leads me to a place where I humble my own heart, because what the heck do I know? And I rely only on God in those moments. And, you know, deeper than that, I only have Christ to rely on ultimately as the foundation of all of those things. But I think on a maybe more superficial level, this book can help us get to that place of awe. And, you know, similar stories that are just full of adventure, they can serve a deeper purpose for us, even if it's not explicit in the words per se. And I think even Jules Verne, I don't know many details about his life, but if I read this, I would probably guess he was at least a deist, you know, that he thought there might have been some sort of creator. And I don't know if that's just a product of his time. He may not have been very spiritual necessarily, but there's a lot of language about, you know, the creator even in woven throughout the story. And for Christians who have a bigger picture of what that means, we can really appreciate that in a different way, I guess.
And well, thank you for listening to this episode of Redeeming Reads. Next month, we're going to be discussing Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan.
Yes, the extremely allegorical story of a Christian.
Yep. And Taylor, you're going to be really excited for that, because I know, I don't know, it's just an ongoing joke that you're always looking for allegory.
Listen, I live for allegory, so.
You know what, here's our first real allegory.
Yeah, well, I didn't get it this month, so we really got to jump
in. No, not at all.
Got to fully embrace it.
Right. Well, thank you for listening to this episode. We'll see you next time.